I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Have you heard? Sling TV offers the news you love for less.
Hey, wait, you look and sound just like me.
I am you. I'm the same news programs on Sling TV for less.
You mean you're me, but for less money?
A lot less.
I'm all the favorite news programs and more on Sling TV, starting at just $40 a month. Everything great about me, but for less money? Which makes me greater, don't you think? Get the news you love and more for less.
Start saving today. Visit Sling.com to see your offer.
Sling. This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Hey, I'm Ruben. My band and I have a new song. I'm also a tow truck driver. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I get to go home at the end of the day and see my bandmates.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Chinchilla Squeaks for another installment. I am Christian Scheller, joining you from an increasingly sunny northern hemisphere. Still a bit chilly, but it's nice to have some sun. I was a little unwell last week, so I didn't put an episode out, but I have quite a bit to go through this episode. And most of it is about AI and banks, as you might expect. It's been quite a few weeks in technology, and even my interview this week with Marshall from Tab 9 is AI related. They have their own coding assistant in competition to many of the others you might have heard of. Let's start with a few links. If you have watched or heard any news, you heard of the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and all the knock-on effect that is now happening. I don't want to dig too much into it. It obviously affects technology. It obviously affects the sector. I still personally work for a tech company, fortunately with no money with them. But of course, probably with a lot of clients, there's going to be a lot of ripple effect from this that we're still yet to experience. And I think it's going to be some rocky times, I must admit. It concerns me ever so slightly. Just having come back from a small career break, maybe having to take another one is not quite what I wanted to do right now. But we'll see. I suppose, I don't know, these things happen. You have to roll with the punches, adapt, as they say. But we'll see what happens. I'm not going to go into any of my own analysis, but I'm going to forward you to 3 of my favorite links on the stories that give different nuances in good detail. The first is from Nitish Power on Slate, which sort of goes through a timeline of what happened from rough start to rough finish. Of course, it's not necessarily finished, but at least from the rough start and how he got here, and what got here and what got us here and why a bank you've probably never heard of has caused such tribulations across a sector. So first start with that one for a little bit of a timeline with some good detail, not just a couple of bullet points. Next is Jeff Stein in the Washington Post talking about, is this a bailout or not? So the American government and also the HSBC in the UK have stepped in to quote unquote bailout / quote unquote save Silicon Valley Bank. Or did they? Actually, it's sort of interesting what's happened, and it's different. And in the States especially, and I guess in the UK to a certain extent, it was remarkably quick, flexible and well thought out. But this post goes into a little bit more detail about what it is and what it's going to be moving forward, and what that might mean for the bank, for their account holders, and et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, Chris Stokel-Walker in Wired covers what the ongoing repercussions might be of this. And this is something that definitely sparked in my mind, the ongoing repercussions of loss of contracts for bigger companies, for safer companies, this ripple effect of people getting the jitters, cancelling business, being less or being more frugal with their money, et cetera, et cetera, and the knock-on effect that will happen. It always makes me think of when a car plant closes and people forget about all the suppliers, from everything from screws up to catering, et cetera, that are also affected by that, and then the knock-on effect of that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're yet to see what all of that will be. And I am talking to you on the day that Credit Suisse also got into more trouble. I think this is one of the interesting things. They've actually been in trouble for some time. It's not necessarily new, but then market jitters will force these things to the forefront. So we will see what we will see, I guess. I will admit, GPT-4 was released yesterday. I haven't really got into detail myself about what that all entails yet, so I won't talk about it maybe until next week. But I am doing research for my next episode of In Bots We Trust, which you can find on my YouTube channel. And we're going to be looking at music. And Killian, my co-host, actually shared a really interesting link with me on Music Radar about quite a famous mixing engineer, Andrew Schleps, talking about how a lot of AI music sort of sounds the same because it's all been trained on the same stuff. And this is something I noticed with some of my experiments, actually. And some of my experiments with some of the AI tools. He talks about certain genres, but I've made quite a few notes of some of the plugins I've seen, and these are not even the kind of full generative AI type music plugins, about how they seem to be so biased towards electronic music. And I haven't really heard much from them. And this could just be the people I'm seeing here, especially in a city like Berlin with a lot of electronic DJs. Where's the acoustic music or something like that? And just how much like all the writing is going to be the same, is the music going to be all the same? And I guess the question you could ask is, does it matter? There's plenty of market for music and generic sounding pop. I mean, that's not new. Human-made music has sounded pretty similar in the charts over the years. And obviously it's different each time, but it could still have a sound for a few years. And a lot of the time it sounds very generic. It comes from people you've never heard of. I think a plethora of just quick buck making AI generated music will flood the charts in the near future, especially now with streaming services. You can just pump out a track, get it out, make some money, pump out another one, et cetera, et cetera. The concept is not new. The methodology is new. The other thing I found very interesting with this article is Andrew has a lot of other outlets of his own thoughts on these issues and others. And there's a lot of really good links in this article. If you're interested in music and music technology at all, then I would recommend you read this article and then follow some of the links to his YouTube channel, to his blog, which I haven't yet got into any detail on, but I certainly will, because it was a really good post that matched a lot of my thoughts, actually. And I think much like everything I'm talking about in this episode, it remains to be seen what's going to happen next and what impact it will have. But it's nice to have these luminaries who've sort of transitioned between eras and scenes to give us some context, I guess, as we make that transition ourselves. And finally, I'm going to cover an article on The Atlantic called The Moral Case Against Equity Language. I found this interesting because I, through my work and some of the open source projects I contribute to, actually actively maintain a couple of tools that help you match your text to style guides, to rulings of how your language should be used. And some of these include insensitive language. Alex is a common one. And I've actually even did a presentation and a blog post and a video on this very subject using this tool last year as well. Things like removing workmen and having workers and gendering of language and et cetera, et cetera. And it seems that this is a trend that has been spreading quite widely, not just through these tools, but actual style guides talking about different words you should use instead of words that were used before. And let's just have a look at some of the examples first. So don't use stand, Americans, blind, and crazy. The first two fail at inclusion because not everyone can stand and not everyone living in the country is a citizen. The third and fourth, even as figures of speech, are insulting to the disabled. And then there are, of course, some wider known but still controversial ones like removing slave. In tech, that's a different conversation, but in this particular case, an enslaved person, it changes the phrasing. And some of these make, I'm trying not to judge these, but some of them I think are easier to maybe see and understand and change thinking around than others, I guess. Like enslaved still, in my mind, sums up the context and the discussion but changes the perspective, which I think is interesting. It's saying that someone else did this to them, and it's not their problem. Well, it is their problem, but you know they didn't do it to themselves, that kind of thing. So, you know, some of them are clearer than others, shall we say. And then a lot of generally kind of NGOs and progressive organizations have adopted a lot of these guides. And this is an American-focused article, but the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, Psychological Association, Medical Association, etc., 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 etc. But the interesting discussion that is had here is that there has become such a gap between the way that a lot of people talk, and this would include a lot of people who are on the fence on these issues, over to ones who are generally opposed to them, that of course being told to use these phrases causes a backlash, as you might expect, as often is the case. Whenever you get one extreme, well, not extreme, but one, I'm going to use the word extreme just to illustrate the point. It's not quite what I mean, I don't know. One extreme action to something, you'll get probably an equally, if not more, extreme reaction to it. So you get a sort of populist backlash. But the other interesting thing is that with some of these words, of course, the people deciding what words we should use are not necessarily the people they represent. So the case in point here is the American Cancer Society advises Latinx, along with the equally gender-neutral Latin, Latinat, and Latinu, should be used. But the argument was a lot of people from those communities had no idea that's what was being used to refer to them, and equally had very little input on whether those should be the words that were used and whether they liked them. And there's some interesting case in point of especially race words and some other community words in minorities, where often actually they repurpose offensive words internally and give them a new life. And sometimes having someone from outside of that circle deem what it is they should be called is kind of more, just as much of a problem. So I think this is often the aspect with this kind of discussion. You have well-meaning people, but the result is not always what is wanted. You end up with either the people who they were aimed to help not being particularly helped, or at worst case being offended. You end up with people on the other side of the discussion who also weren't really involved, just pissed off and angry and thus causing a worse reaction against things. You know, someone who is maybe on the fence about Latin people or transgender people being told they have to use this certain language then makes them more resentful about a group that they weren't even necessarily resentful about in the first place. This kind of thing. And then there's another sub-discussion in here saying that even people who work under these guidelines often break them because they don't understand them, they're too confusing, they don't always make sense, and end up inventing their own terms that they feel kind of match the guidelines, but are different. And so you end up with a big muddle of different words that no one really understands what they mean and whether they are deemed offensive or not, et cetera, et cetera. So I would recommend, if this interests you at all, this subject, and it kind of does, evolution of language does interest me quite a lot, have a read of it to dig into some of the subtleties. I may not be summarizing it quite so well as I could be, because, you know, sometimes that happens. And but the topic is an interesting one, and how language can evolve. Language evolves in its own way, and sometimes that's almost better than deeming what language should be from above. And letting the, I suppose in summary, letting the people you're trying to help dictate that language instead. And that may not be the way you want it to be, but that may be the better way to go about evolving language. Your thoughts on a postcard or an email or a social media message. You can find my contact details at kristenschiller.com if you have any input on this or any of the other stories I've covered. Now, my interview with Marshall of Tab 9, covering their AI-assisted code editor and how it compares to the increasing amount of competition. Enjoy. Today, I'm joined by Marshall Jung of Tab 9. Now, Tab 9 calls itself an AI assistant for software developers, but this has been something we've heard about a lot recently. But I do believe that Tab 9 is not what you may immediately think of. What is Tab 9 and what is it doing in this very busy space at the moment for AI code completion?
Yes, thank you for the question. I appreciate being here today. Code completion tools have been around for quite some time. Most developers would be familiar with the sort of semantic suggestions that could pop up in any of them. The advent of transformer models or language models in general allowed any sort of language, programming languages being one of them, to be incorporated as sort of a more robust suggestion engine for developers inside their IDE. Tab 9 started about 8 years ago. We started first in the Java space, but have expanded to most common languages. And recently, in the last 2 to 3 years, have started actually utilizing these large language models with some fine tuning in them to provide both inline and larger snippet suggestions for developers while they're working directly in their IDE. But as we will hopefully cover today, that isn't really the only tool that you can extract from these types of models. One of the ones we just released is unit testing. So, for example, you can ask the same tool to generate unit tests on existing code inside of your IDE or your repository. So we can certainly break down how that works, but it's just one of many features that can be engineered out of these types of algorithms.
Let's go back a step. You said for about 8 years. I mean, there's been kind of not AI-based, but completion-based tools based on linting and common patterns and type definitions and things like that for some time in IDEs. You know, they're basically just sort of reading what information they have available to them and not necessarily context aware, just filling in things here and there. But 8 years ago, for this kind of level of AI based completion is pretty ahead of its time. So as far as I'm aware, so what brought you here? What was the journey to create the product in the first place?
Yeah, so our two founders actually recognized this type of a tool as being something a little bit more robust, and then there's some market opportunity for this. They actually built upon the tool, which is originally built by a developer in Canada. He exited and wanted to do different things, but our two developers, our two founders, picked that up and said, well, based in the Java language, at least initially, there was some robust testing around generative adversarial networks, or GANs, which sort of predated the whole transformer neural networks, which came around in 2017. So they started using these very small models, largely trained to run on an individual developer's laptop. So they were that small at the time. And it was just an enhancement to the existing suggestions. They were literally just building slightly longer suggestions within those sort of standard IDE-based context context type suggestions for your cursor. And then, you know, once the transformer models came around, they decided that this was something that they could build a little bit larger. So it was sort of an iterative understanding of where these types of technologies were being used. And they were kind of the first in the market when it came to understanding, you know, integrations as well, because as much as it's interesting to build these types of models with the mathematics and the engineering on the back end, getting them to a developer in a way that allows them to be more efficient is actually a relatively difficult user interface problem to solve. So a lot of the engineering goes along, how do you take these types of features, which you can easily engineer and deliver them to a developer in a way that allows them to use them successfully, rather than it being a sort of mental burden on their development process.
I must admit, I'm actually surprised to hear that it's been around just as an idea for some time, I guess because of all the noise in the room from the past few years. How widely used were they? I mean, I could look at your client list and see quite a few well-recognized names, but how widely used have these tools been before the buzz recently?
Not much, right? I mean, even before, I think some other tools came out in 2022, Tabnine had a fair number of individual users, but it was really sort of a, there was a free model out there, and then you could pay for sort of an upgraded model, but it was really individual students. It was individual developers, freelancers that used these type of tools. And to a certain extent, we're both extremely happy and a little bit overwhelmed at all of the publicity that has come out around these types of tools in the last one. And truthfully, it really kicked off when OpenAI released ChatGPT, and this type of technology really came to the forefront. Although a lot of people who had worked in this industry for a while weren't particularly surprised about that coming out. I mean, I think we all perhaps remembered there was a Google employee in early 2022 that ended up, I think, going public about how the internal Google AI had become sentient. And everybody kind of scoffed at the time. But in reality, we started to kind of see these types of things function. And so when ChatGPT came out, the wave started, and Tabnine has pretty successfully, I think, started to build some name recognition around this type of technology.
And there's two things I could kind of see that you do a little bit differently from some of the other options, as far as I'm aware. One that I think seems interesting for the I guess the business model you're going for, the fact that you can learn, match, and I guess train on private repos. So you sort of build up this internal style of completion, as opposed to just completion from anywhere. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. Think about it kind of like a pyramid, for example. There's a lot of what I call foundational models out there. You hear them referred to pretty commonly. There's GPT. Google will have Lambda. There's Bloom, AI21. So there's a bunch of these foundational models, but they require a lot of computing power and a fair amount of money to do. So smaller companies don't necessarily have access, the ability to build those models. But we do is we take the next step up in the pyramid. And what you can do is fine tune these models. It's a type of transfer learning. And you can take a narrower data set and you can then kind of focus that foundational model on this narrower data set and deliver a model that is more, is better at a particular task. And it doesn't have to be programming languages. You could really do this with anything from the foundational models. But for us, that's what we do is we harness the best of breed from these large foundational models and then use it to train a smaller corpus of data that we both quality control and make sure is sort of fully open sourced, you know, permissive licenses, high quality code. And we build sort of a large Tab 9 open source model. From there, you can focus even further up the pyramid at taking that type of model and fine tuning it again on, say, customer code. And so if they have non-proprietary data, perhaps data that's never been in the open source, you can then train a model specifically on that code and deliver it to their teams running in their environment, which gives you some flexibility to meet both security and perhaps compliance constraints.
Yeah, yeah. And I can definitely see that with some of the clients you list, like SpaceX, NVIDIA, BMW, O2, Cisco, these sorts of companies that would be very, I think, would be want to be very cautious about what got in and what got out.
Yeah, indeed.
And similarly, I notice you mention, where was it? Code native models. And I don't know if this is something that's unique to Tab9 or if it's across some of the other tools, but it sort of seems bizarrely obvious that you'd want to only train a model on things that are relevant. There's no point training Java on JavaScript, for example. But is that unique to you and the other tools just filter it out? Or is that unique to you and you're more specialized, or do the other tools sort of just train on everything and just filter out based on the current language?
Essentially, yes. This is a little, there's some nuance to that.
Yeah.
There is some patterns that perhaps run across multiple coding languages. So while you can train a model on like a specific language, you oftentimes will gain flexibility and robustness in a model if you want to give it to somebody who might work slightly outside of what the data set that it was specifically trained on. So there's a balancing act and a bit of an art there for not over specifying the training data set. So you end up with a rigid model, which doesn't work the second you step out of its knowledge base. But keep in mind, since these are sort of natural language type models under it, there's value to having documentation, for example, matched with the base code so that you can have that conversational interaction. And of course, you can turn it around the other direction and generate documentation from code, for example. It's a two-way street. So when it comes to like code native, as you want to be both very targeted with your data, understand its quality, its provenance, and its applicability, but also not over constrain that model such that whatever you end up training for your customer works brilliantly for the first couple of weeks. And then as they sort of mature in the development, they suddenly step outside the model's area of expertise and suddenly it doesn't work very well. So there's a lot of balancing act there that I think is interesting.
So you touched on kind of other side uses of tools like Tab9. And you recently announced a feature that I would imagine will probably make a lot of developers and their managers quite happy, AI-powered unit testing generation. Mm-hmm. Firstly, just going back a step, do you currently or indeed will you in the future also generate other sorts of tests, or is it just unit tests for the time being?
The new feature generates unit tests, which I think most of our enterprises have asked for. It is a bit of what we call the grimly details that most developers really do not want to do. Yeah. So taking that burden off their hands is something I think we can have a lot of impact with. But yeah, your question is pretty accurate. If you think about how you want to use these tools, if it's not just unit testing, if you have a place where you can train that model and say larger integration tests that you would have within that overall code base, there isn't any reason you couldn't train it to generate larger tests itself. Just give it the examples to train on and away you go.
And how do you give, I mean, the thing, of course, with tests is they're supposed to be there to give developers the confidence that code works as designed, but we all know the concept of flaky tests and unreliable tests and things like that. So how do you give people using this the confidence that these auto-generated tests will be useful, will be reliable?
It's a good question because, you know, we're not really in the business of trying to replace engineers, even test engineers, right? We don't, we're not interested in replacing them. So ultimately, we're not asking a company to trust us in blindly as in generate tests. If it says pass, you know, you're good. Yeah. There's still a review process, and we certainly don't want Tab 9 to take the place of any sort of security and compliance review of the code either. So it shortens that software development life cycle, but does not replace anything in it. The confidence would come largely with the integration directly in the IDE. So if you're generating larger tests and you have within that model both the source code that you're trying to integrate as well as sort of the knowledge base for the integration testing itself, you can do the overall model performance by holding out a certain level of those generated tests and then back testing them for accuracy and basically run those metrics until you're quite confident that the tests that are generated are at above a certain level that you believe to be accurate, right? And now none of these are ever going to be 100% accurate. It's not the nature of machine learning. But any of these models generate metrics as you test them. And if it doesn't meet that, well, then you might want to go back and reconsider. Perhaps there's some additional data that needs to be included.
Yeah. I think this is a lot of where these tools will fill in the future is doing a lot of the grunt work that hopefully people then edit and approve. But of course, remains to be seen whether they do or they don't. But
right, yep.
that's the ideal. Just picking up on some other things you sort of mention a little bit in your blog around the differences between Tab 9 and Copilot. I don't really want to go into the details of that, because I think Copilot's had enough exposure as it is. Mm-hmm. But one of the controversies is the fact it's picked up code that people didn't necessarily want included in models. Mm-hmm. How do you prevent something similar happening?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think this is probably the number one question we get from enterprise customers who are looking at evaluating these tools. The true fact of the matter is generative AI can always, no matter how much you don't like the idea, can always copy code, right? Mm. It can actually bring code in from the training data set and propagate it. And of course, we've seen examples of that online with Copilot. It's a risk you run with generative AI, and it doesn't matter whose tool it is, right? The way that you minimize that, and I always bang this home with customers, is you've got to understand the data that your model is trained on. You can't get away from just, you know, emptying the entire bin into the training, pipeline and just, you know, hit the go button. Yes, it will train a model there, but if you truly don't understand what's going into your model, you probably can't trust what's coming out of it. Now, Tab 9 specifically and very deliberately takes the tack that we train only on fully permissive open source repositories, and all of them are both reviewed from our perspective on sort of a quality control basis. You know, is it a good, well-starred? Is it have good contributions? And then we also do scan that code as well to make sure that we're not introducing any sort of known vulnerabilities into the training data set. But again, if there is a zero-day exploit out there and we don't catch it because nobody knows about it, yeah, that can be introduced into the models. And I think that's something that everybody who uses these tools should be fully aware of. The only way to truly get around that is building a fully custom model without foundational training on an enterprise's underlying code, which is fully possible to do, but requires a fair amount of expertise, additional cost, and an effort. So, yep, you've hit on a lot of these details, and it's good that you ask them because people need to know it. Yeah.
And just one other thing, because it's sort of something I just glanced over in the blog post press release for the unit test generation. And I'm not 100% sure if this is strictly true with Copilot. You claim here that at least with the unit test generation, I don't know if it's similar with every other aspect, but that Tab 9 does learn from code as you write it. Is that also a point of difference between you and Copilot, or have I just misunderstood that with...
Tab 9 has the ability to do what we call team training. So it's kind of like there isn't, at least to my knowledge yet, and I'm learning new things every day, right? At least to my knowledge, there's no such thing as a real-time reinforcement large language model. Like that doesn't exist. But what you can do if your model is relatively small enough is you can capture user inputs or edits perhaps to suggested code and then use that as a retraining process on sort of a short order situation, right? So you can do sort of, we'll call it batch learning on these types of situations. So that is something that you certainly can engineer within a deployment for an enterprise. Yeah. Mm.
And what about some of the other areas of the software development workflow that developers don't always like to work on? I guess things like documentation. I have actually tried Copilot with writing and it does okay. Yep. Can Tab 9 handle anything like that as well?
We are planning to release that this year. Okay. And again, like I said earlier, like large language models don't just take sort of natural language and generate code. You can take code and generate natural language. And that's what Copilot is doing. But again, the truth of the matter is what kind of documentation was used as an augmentation to the code that you're trying to generate? Because of course, it's going to go out there, look at that code, find similar pattern code, and then try to generate the documentation that went along with that code. Now, if that code is, or that documentation is written in, let's be honest, most engineers are just going to try to get as much detail and as few words as possible. And some of it might not even be like truly English. Going the other direction is going to be tough because the algorithm doesn't innately understand English. Yep. So it might be generating a little bit of difficult to read documentation. Yep. So again, if you've got great documentation for your code, by all means, if you're working with Tab 9 to train a custom model, please include it because that will always make things better.
Are there any other areas you can think of that this would be applicable to? I don't know. I'm trying to think of there's so many kind of things as code now. Are there other places that AIs could assist with the generation of? I don't know. Maybe you've got better ideas than me.
I spend most of my day focused on the code space, but outside of Tab 9 in general, you have the opportunity to generate these types of things in the medical field. And I think that OpenAI released kind of the BioGPT engine specifically around, hey, I'm going to train it on a bunch of medical databases. And then I ask it questions. Can it give me back technical, feedback documentation or even diagnoses based on a series of observed, characteristics, right? That might be a thing that can do. These models will probably enhance chatbots for helping out, whether you've got an issue with your... sky's the limit here, but obviously I think real applications are going to end up being very specific, right? Yeah. And in industry verticals, I say, and this is sort of my speech, I really love the idea of the sort of ChatGPT or the conversational AI, which is really broad. But ultimately, I don't see how that's truly disruptive to like individual industries. They're going to want something like that, but trained very narrowly to avoid lots of issues, but mostly to become a little bit deeper and less wide, if that makes sense. Yeah.
And actually, something I probably should have asked at the beginning, but it just occurred to me, like, what's the kind of highest level a developer can go with Tab 9? Is it purely around, I've started typing a function, it starts kind of having a look at what I'm doing and trying to add completion? Or can I say, write a function that loops through the alphabet and et cetera, et cetera, and then it just does the whole thing?
Yeah, there's two different ways, and I think you kind of hit on, there's people use Tab9 and these tools in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. The conversational style, which, you know, I demonstrate to a lot of folks, which is start writing a comment and be as descriptive as possible of what you want it to do. Oftentimes changing a few specifics in that comment and being more like, if you have an idea of what maybe the library name is or the function name is, that can oftentimes help. So that's a way to get like a longer, more like fully fledged function where you generate the entire thing top to the bottom. But that actually isn't the way that we find that most developers use Tab9. They tend to use it in sort of the flow state, right? They don't want to type a comment and then have to come out of that to debug 15, 20 lines of code. What they would prefer is like they know what they're doing. So they would prefer just to have an inline comment or sorry, an inline suggestion that is, you know, just completes the rest of the line or might complete the parameters for a particular function that you're asking for. And because they can almost subconsciously see that suggestion and say yes or no, hit the accept, hit the tab button, and then move on from there. We actually see more senior programmers love to use Tab9 that direction. And the more junior folks who might just be starting with a team or just, you know, getting started in their careers will actually interact with it on the more conversational style.
No, it's a good point, actually. I think it's been something that's really sort of been lauded over the past a few months around, oh, I could just write this description and get code. But it's like, I think it's comparable with people saying, oh, you know, musicians and writers and artists, no one will want to do anything anymore. It's like, I think you forget that we actually do these things because we enjoy them.
Yeah, it's true.
And sometimes the going through that process is actually fun as a human. Mm-hmm. And just because a tool exists doesn't mean we want to use it that way.
Exactly. Yeah. Trying to give the options for people to use it in their own way, I think is a great way to get adoption. Yeah.
So final two questions. The last one is just in this increasingly busy space, how will you keep ahead of the competition and make sure that people also hear about you and your offer to ensure that?
Yes, it's shouting into a hurricane right now in terms of the PR space. And, you know, we're just a small startup, less than 40 folks around the globe. So, you know, we are fighting, we're fighting an uphill battle. But I think the way that we're going to plan on doing that is one, working with some great PR folks and, you know, spending some time out there. But the other one is we're really listening to enterprise customers, right? Mm-hmm. We're going in there and saying, this is new to them as well. And they want to know how to best use this and also use it in a way that is, you know, secure and compliant with the way that most of them operate. And when you listen to them, that really sets our pipeline for how we want to engineer specifically to enterprise asks. So, you know, that's the way we're going to continue to do it. And I think we're going to find some good success there.
Mm-hmm. And I can see if anyone is interested in doing some comparison, there is a free tier, which just gives these short completions. Mm-hmm. And open source training. Mm-hmm. And then the pro one adds in, I think, some of that, what you said about writing comments and things like that, and also the internal learning. I think that's the thing that's most interesting. So there's also a free trial.
Indeed.
See if that works for you.
Yep.
I'm also fascinated to see you offer integration with most of the expected editors, but also a couple of unexpected ones as well. Vim, Emacs, which I don't think any of the others support. So, and they're pretty popular. So,
yep, yeah, that's a bit of a Pandora's box. Once you start, you know, supporting all these IDs, you have to continue supporting the IDs, and they all change at different velocities and rates. So, we do find that most people are VS Code or any of the JetBrains IDs, but there's a surprising number of people who use Vim, and you know that's why we try to support that. So, and of course, we're always open to additional suggestions from enterprise if they have it.
Out of pure interest, just because I have also tested it, it's not as widely known. But have you also looked at JetBrains Gradsy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're always trying to sort of see where the competition is coming and how they're working. I'm not familiar with the back end for the JetBrains, like exactly how they're doing what they're doing. A surprising number of these sort of AI code startups are like, I don't blame them, right? They're taking advantage of the PR right now, but they're a bit thin wrapper. So, you know, you peel back the hood and it's a UX on top of an API called a GPT, which, mind you, is fine, right? But you know, you have to realize that I think to be really successful in this space, especially with enterprise customers, there's no getting away from hosting your own infrastructure, having your own ML engineering knowledge. That's key to being successful here, I think.
I think that's going to be a big topic moving forward. I was at a meetup a couple of weeks ago on this very topic. And just, you know, we've already had this black box of understanding code and the vulnerabilities in it, and now we're adding an even bigger box to that that I think a lot of people will really want to understand before they just unleash it on their business.
that is a really salient point and observation, right? I think I wrote a sort of an ethics type blog that's posted, and it really is, you know, are we kind of removing human creativity by putting these tools in place for, you know, hey, they're all going to sort of be suggesting the same thing, so why think outside the box? I think there's certainly ethical considerations with these tools. We can't get away from that.
Fantastic. Just as a nice little wrap up, you've mentioned a few things along the way, but what else is on the roadmap for, say, the next 6 months?
On our side, we're going to be teaming the LLM suggestions as an input prompt for enterprise search. So this is a way for companies to absolutely guarantee best practice distribution to their individual developers on a global scale. A lot of enterprises like this idea. And I think that's pretty interesting. We're also going to try to integrate Tab9 with the PR/MR process. So you submit code and it analyzes that and then might come back and say, hey, there's a couple of other files over here that are very similar. You might want to check those out as well. So just trying to lower that barrier. Yep.
I think you did. Was I wrong? I feel like you. Oh no! How can AI code assistant help reduce production bugs? You can now talk about how it can also help you refactor, I suppose.
Indeed. Yep. That'll be a thing as well.
Brilliant. Awesome. Thanks very much for your time.
Yes. Thank you for having me on.
And that was my interview with Marshall from Tab9. A few updates from me. I have a post on Medium about my creative writing setup, which is actually proving quite popular. Getting a lot of feedback on Medium from it. And I'm just about to publish the text version of my video on writing with JetBrains' new tech writing plugins for IntelliJ IDEs. I looked at PseudoWrite, which is quite an interesting creative writing-focused AI assistant. I looked at Decap CMS, the rebranded project of Netlify CMS, which doesn't quite work right now, but I took a look at it anyway. I looked at NixOS and the ecosystem around it last week, and I think that's it. I've also got another post I'm going to be publishing in the next couple of days. I locked myself out of the house last Friday and wrote a post on how I managed to somehow work on my phone all day, or maybe I didn't, so you can find that there. I think that's everything for now. My new website is still getting updates here, there, and everywhere. And I'll be putting out some short story collections very soon, but I'm just getting some artwork commissioned there. So I think that is everything for now. Head on over to christianchilder.com. for everything I mentioned and video schedule for the next week. And I will be in Portugal in the next week and a bit. So if you happen to be there and want to meet up, send me a message and we'll see if we can arrange something. But until then, thank you very much for joining me and take care, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at christianchilder.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm getting married today. I'm also a firefighter and first responder. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can make it to my ceremony to start the next chapter of my life.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.